Blog Talk Radio and Virtually Speaking Science. It is Wednesday, July 22, 2015. We are live in Second Life, where we are hosted by the Exploratorium and joined by a digitally present studio audience who comment and pose questions in real time. Many of the books discussed in our hour-long podcast can be found online in the Virtually Speaking collection at exploratorium.edu. Today's host is Kelly Hills, ethicist, professional editor, and writer in the medical sciences and humanities. Kelly publishes her ethics-focused commentaries, where she considers the ethical, legal, and social implications of emerging technologies, DIY, biotech, clinical medicine, and public health, first and most frequently on life as an extreme sport. Today, Kelly talks with Dr. Madhu Kati, evolutionary ecologist and associate professor of vertebrate ecology in the biology department at Cal State University, Fresno. You can follow his Twitter feed at Leaf Warbler and Kelly at Roxa, which is R-O-C-Z-A. And with that, we are over to you, Kelly.
Thank you so much, Sherry. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Blog Talk and Virtually Speaking Science. It's a very warm evening here in Philadelphia, and that kind of makes it a good night, I think, to talk urban ecology, because all the critters are out. Humans, animals, insects, everything I can see out my window right now. And you can certainly see how, even though we've managed to pave a good chunk of the Philadelphia region, there's still an awful lot of wildlife out there. Dr. Madhu Kati is my guest tonight, and hi, thank you for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Kelly. It's been we've talked about this for a while, so I'm glad we finally able to make it.
Yeah, as you guys know, he is married to Kaberi, who was my guest last month. So this is kind of the second part of a talk that we originally had wanted to do in April on Earth Day, and then I got sick, and we had to cancel at the last minute. So they were both very gracious to reschedule, and I do appreciate that. So you are a biologist, and you've been doing biology for 20-odd years, first in India and then in the U.S. You got your PhD from UC San Diego, and I see it was on the ecology and the evolution of non-breeding distribution in old world leaf warblers, which might confirm some people's suspicions about scientists being really, really specific in their interests. So how in the world did you get interested in zoology and biology and all this sort of, like, take us back to the beginning and kind of give us an idea of what makes somebody who ends up being you.
Wow. Okay. You're taking me really back. Well, without taking up the entire hour with my biography, let me try and briefly bring you up to speed. I grew up in India, just outside Bombay, in a suburb, and became interested in evolutionary biology and environmental issues at around the same time when I got to college. And I did my college in the main city in Bombay, and it was an interesting sort of period because I was becoming aware of the social environmental issues in that city, and more globally. I was reading, I read Silent Spring, I read Barry Commoner's Closing the Circle, at the same time as I was discovering Stephen Jay Gould's writings and Darwin and evolutionary biology in general. So I had sort of been raised, like many Indians, even now, I think, to basically, you know, try to be a doctor. I failed my parents' dream of doing that quite miserably, but I did develop a keen interest in biology. So that's kind of how both these environmental interests as well as the academic interest in evolution sort of came together. And I also discovered, I actually became a bird watcher in the city of Bombay, which is kind of a odd thing to say, but that's, you know, Bombay is a tropical city. It has what, 25 million people or so now. It's one of the mega cities. It was pretty big even back then. And I'm talking about the early to mid 1980s. And even though it is a densely populated city with high levels of poverty, it also happens to contain within the municipal limits 100 square kilometers of moist deciduous tropical forest, almost like a cloud forest, which is a national park.
Oh wow.
Yeah. And of course this patch of forest was protected initially because it was the main watershed for the city. And of course now the city has grown beyond that, and it completely surrounds this park. But because it's designated a national park, the forest remains reasonably intact, despite, you know, the dense urban development all around it, as well as slums and so on. But the park remains good enough habitat that it actually even has a population of leopards. So
that's got to be a pretty big size park then, because those cats need a lot of room.
Yeah, but it turns out the leopards are actually quite adaptable to human habitation. They've done generally quite well, and they like eating dogs, among other things.
Oh dear! So they're kind of like the Indian equivalent of the Southern California cougar.
Yeah.
That's what
it reminds me of. You know, it's like you have the Hollywood cougar here, and you have the Bollywood ones in Bombay. And it although I think the leopards are maybe a little bit more adaptable across a wide range of habitats, and they come into more frequent conflict with people as well. Anyway, so that's the context in which sort of I was growing up. And then, you know, behind me, if you're in Second Life and you're looking at the screen, behind me there's a picture of the flamingos on the screen. Mm-hmm. That's that picture I took in Bombay a couple of years ago. And that's in a creek that opens up into Bombay's harbor. Right? It's one of the busiest harbors in India.
Wow.
And yet you have something like 10,000 to 25,000 of these lesser flamingos wintering there in the and the interesting thing is that these birds didn't used to be common in that area when I was becoming a bird watcher, you know, in the 80s when I actually lived in Bombay. It's only in the last 15 or 20 years, with some changes in the patterns of development, that has allowed mangroves forest to come back along that creek, that for some reason these flamingos have sort of rediscovered this wintering habitat, and now they are there in pretty large numbers.
So that's an example of
how, you know, wildlife can live in the middle of a mega city.
Yeah. Now are flamingos native to Mumbai area?
Yeah, they are native. You know, you have a couple of species of flamingos that breed in India and winter. So you have them. The breeding areas are a little bit to the north and west. So in the Gujarat area and for the north, you have these large sort of area, you know, like in Africa, you have the desert salt flat kind of habitat they'll move up there and when the monsoons come, that's when they'll breed. And then in the winter, they migrate further south, and you have this one large population that's been coming to Bombay.
I had no idea. That's fascinating. So we already have a question from the Second Life audience. And the question is basically just not getting it. Like, there's just this park in the middle and there's just leopards. I think that sounds so exotic to us,
yeah,
those of us in America, probably because we, you know, we don't actually see our wildlife as exotic. And I know I tell this story every time we talk about the differences in perspective, and one of these mm-hmm. days he's going to get tired of me telling everybody this, but you know, my husband is Australian and there are not squirrels in Australia.
Yes.
So for me, squirrels, you know, they're urban rats, right?
Uh-huh. Yes.
But every time he sees a squirrel, he stops like the
yes.
dog and up, and it's just squirrel.
Yeah.
Adorable, but I'm the same way. You know, you take me to Australia and I turn the corner and I go, ah, because there's a kangaroo just standing there looking at me. And he's like, oh God, another kangaroo. And I'm like, oh my God, there's a kangaroo like right there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think for a lot of people, this idea that there's a big old park in the middle of Bombay that has leopards, like, how do you deal with that as people? I mean, do they come out and do they eat you? Do they hunt you? Do you, you know, how does that work?
There are conflicts. There are occasional attacks. Not too many people getting killed. But as I said, dogs are more often preferred.
Mm-hmm.
But conflicts do happen. And, you know, there are occasionally people get into problems. And you know, if you look in recent years, not so much in Bombay, but in other places, where leopards have also been coming into urban, suburban, human inhabited areas, there have been increasing
mm-hmm.
reports of conflicts. And if you look on YouTube, you might even find videos of you know, leopards sort of like what happened with that the cougar in LA a couple of months ago.
Yes,
it was trapped in, you know, in somebody's basement, or was taking
right.
a nap, I think. And
yeah. You know, this is kind of just chilling and was like, no, I'm good, thanks. I'll stay
yeah.
here.
So,
y'all don't
so,
need to bother me.
Yeah, so leopards might do that as well, although they tend to, you know, hide more in the forest and in the trees, but they do come out at night. And they seem to be quite good at being secretive. But occasionally they'll, you know, people will discover them, and sometimes it can get quite ugly with people chasing them around and, you know,
right.
sometimes killing them, which is problematic. But
mm-hmm.
you know, if you get a large carnivore in the middle of a high density of people, conflicts are hard to avoid.
Yeah. I think Americans might be more familiar with that with wolves and cattle ranchers. You know,
yep.
I think everybody wants to conserve wolves at this point. I mean, who doesn't love a beautiful
mm-hmm.
wolf? Well, if you're a cattle rancher, you might not love the beautiful wolf pack that just moved up the mountain from you. And so I think, I suspect that some of it's just, it's one of the things that was really interesting. Last month's conversation with Kiberi was talking about how people have such a almost myopic view of what wildlife interactions are and what urban science is. And how we tend to talk about it only in the perspective of often the developed world. So things like wolves and cattle ranchers, and we don't stop to think about what it necessarily means to do urban ecology in one of these rapidly developing areas of the globe.
Yeah. Yeah. And wolves is an interesting example, because you're talking about wolves and cattle ranchers, which is actually in a context where the human population density is generally low. And
yes.
it's more of a perceived risk rather than
mm-hmm.
actual risk. Whereas here,
right.
if you think about, I think maybe a population, they estimate maybe a couple of dozen leopards living in Bombay. And, you know, they're surrounded by 24 million people, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
So the density and the likelihood of encounter is much higher. Yet
right.
there remains this context of sort of a cultural context in India where people are more tolerant of these animals.
Mm-hmm.
So,
why do you think that is?
I actually wrote about this many years ago. I think part of it has to do with the cultural and religious context.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, India is predominantly Hindu, and its pantheon of many gods includes, you know, the elephant god and the monkey god and generally a number of wildlife species are sort of part of a religious ritual, mm-hmm. if not directly worshipped as gods. And mm-hmm. so there is a cultural context of tolerance. And I think there's also the other element of people being, you know, the philosophical outlook being a little bit more fatalistic, perhaps, you know, that if people are more willing to accept costs of, say, cattle being killed by leopards, or, you know, chicken being picked up by, or your dog being eaten or something like that.
Right.
As maybe it was part of the fate, mm-hmm. For good or evil, you know, for good or ill, that's kind of my take on why there is this context of more tolerance. And
yeah, I've heard and, that. But that
tolerance is also, you know, being frayed because population densities are high, development is, you know, mm-hmm. spreading all over the continent. So it's the pressures and frequency of conflict with wildlife is much higher now, which does make right. it difficult for everybody, especially in the current generation, to retain that same level of tolerance. But that context is what I think provides mm-hmm. some opportunities for developing newer models of coexistence.
Yeah, but I think that's really interesting. And I really like hearing you and your colleagues talking about this, because like I said, it really did strike me when I first started getting mm-hmm. to know you and some of the other urban ecology people, just how little we actually hear about it outside of what are we going to do with the latest Hollywood cougar, or, you know, the coyotes in Phoenix, things like that. You were right. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that, I mean, that comes, the reason why we know little about it also comes back to the first question you asked me, which is, you know, how did I come mm-hmm. to be doing this?
Right.
Because, well, you know, after becoming a birder in Bombay and discovering biologist, I sort of went off to get a degree in wildlife biology, a master's degree from the mm-hmm. Wildlife Institute of India. And mm-hmm. studying wildlife biology formally, I did what everybody does, which is run as far away from the city as possible. You want to find what you think of as undisturbed wilderness or right. natural habitat.
Mm-hmm.
It took a long time for me to realize that actually doesn't really exist in that ideal wilderness form anymore. Human activities impact all habitats everywhere on the planet. And so I spent the first half of my graduate career sort of working in remote places. And I did surveys in the Himalaya. I did my master's research in Kashmir. I worked mm-hmm. wow. I did wildlife surveys in the remote parts in the eastern end of the Himalaya, you know, east of Bhutan, which is
wow.
which was pretty wild and inaccessible at that time. It's more accessible now, but still mm-hmm. remains pretty wild, rainforest habitat. And then for my PhD research, when I came to California in 1990 now, I ended up focusing my PhD research on leaf warblers. The birds you see, again, for those in Second Life, it's on the screen behind me.
What is this?
Leaf warbler.
We've had some questions in the Second Life chat room. It's just been like, okay, hang on, guys, hang on. We're going to get there. Yeah. What's a leaf warbler?
Yeah, so the leaf warblers are small insect-eating birds that, because of their sort of green, olive-green coloration, they tend to look like leaves.
Okay.
Hence the name leaf warbler. You know, they sing, so they are warblers in that sense. And they... They're really small. I know the picture looks big there, but these birds weigh between 7 to 12 grams. So they're really tiny.
Small.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the group includes something like, I think around 40 different species, depending on which taxonomist
wow.
you talk to. Yeah. But they're all distributed in what we call the Old World, right, which is in Eurasia. So you find them all the way, you know, from across the northern latitudes. They breed from about, you know, the Himalayan mountain range north to the Arctic Circle, wherever there is forest
wow.
or scrub habitat. Yeah, you find them all over there.
Really big range.
Yeah, for the group as a whole, right? There's 40 species. Some of them mm-hmm. have larger ranges, some of them have smaller ranges. And mm-hmm. they're all migratory. Some,
okay.
like the ones in the Himalaya, relatively short distance migration, they might just drop, some species might just drop down in elevation. Whereas others, like the Arctic warbler, actually breeds above the Arctic Circle and winters in southern Africa. So think about a 10-gram bird flying all the way from the Arctic Circle to South Africa.
That's impressive.
Yes. These are extremely impressive species, although they, you know, they're not particularly colorful.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to have minor variation in their plumage. You know, they might have different sort of markings on their wings or on the head, which might distinguish them, or their songs are different. But usually they tend to get lumped as sort of these little green jobs by many amateur birders because they're hard to tell apart.
And they're kind of the same color and they all
yeah,
look about the same.
Generally,
they're kind of just,
yeah.
oh, boring. They're not flashy like the cardinal.
Yes, they are not flashy. They're not flashy like the American warblers. Mm-hmm. These old world warblers tend to be generally sort of in the yellowish green to olive green range. With a few markings on the wings, perhaps, that might distinguish them. They do sing quite a bit in the breeding season. But again, most of Africa, you know, so the birds breed in the northern range. And in the winter, you have a number of species that winter in Africa, number of species that winter in South Asia, and all the way, you know, towards Japan. So all across Asia.
What you're saying is, these little guys have adapted to humans because you're talking about ranges that humans
yeah, are yeah.
strong population.
Yeah, and yeah, that is indeed the case. And the group is thought to have evolved in the Himalaya probably, you know, before or around the time of the last big the Pleistocene glaciation event, when mm-hmm. most of, you know, Asian main continental mass didn't really have suitable habitat. So once the glaciers withdrew, the populations moved north, especially mm-hmm. tracking sort of coniferous and deciduous trees, and diversified. So you have this radiation of species along there. I noticed somebody was asking if they're like Galapagos examples, and you know, they're not exactly the same way, but I do have an interesting collection of the Galapagos because my PhD advisor, who's been studying speciation in these birds, he did his PhD work on Galapagos finches.
Oh, so, interesting. So for those of yeah. you who aren't following along in Second Life right now, we've had some questions that I put on the table for a minute about Galapagos and basically evolution. And mm-hmm. the question is, at hand is, are species able to adapt and evolve to human interference, or do humans interfere too much? And, you know, so sort of like, what do we see with the Galapagos finches, and how can we track that onto other creatures? And more importantly, you know, is human change faster than biology can adapt or not? Which seems like that's a really important question to anybody who's doing urban ecology. You know, can species mm-hmm. adapt to living with us? Because I think, frankly, the chances of humans adapting to live with other species is pretty slim.
I don't know. I'm an optimist on that score.
somebody has to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, I was going to say, so, you know, I spent my PhD years, so most of the 90s sort of working in national parks and relatively remote places, studying the migratory, you know, ecology and evolution of this group of birds.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only after that, as a postdoc, that I got opportunities to start getting into urban ecology. And that's what I've done since about 2000, formally. As an urban ecologist, but going back to, you know, when I started, as I mentioned, I've always been interested in this intersection of social and environmental issues. So I've
mm-hmm.
kept that broad interest, and I've always right. sought to apply what I learn in evolutionary ecology and evolutionary biology to trying to address some real world problems in the environmental arena, because I think, you know, that's where I sort of feel that I can make the most contribution, perhaps. And urban ecology is where things have coalesced. And in a way, it's like, you know, coming back home, because I grew up in a city where, right, you know, there was wildlife around and I sort of saw things, but I didn't really have anyone who could help me identify the things we saw in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't much natural history knowledge widely available. And, you know, so from that sort of beginning, I've come back to studying wildlife in people's yards now.
I think that's fun. I know that some people who have been following my antics on Twitter the last couple of weeks know that I've been trying my hand at shade gardening this year, giving up the ghost for the hopes of growing anything edible. And of course, I didn't do anything natural to the Philadelphia region. I'm a horrible person, but in my defense, it's all in pots, so I'm not letting anything invasive out. And part of that for us has been putting up wildlife feeders, and all three cats think that this is just the best thing ever. I've been a little concerned. I mean, you know, I've got cat TV. I mean, if we had Nielsen ratings going, I'd be at the top here. We get all kinds of birds here. But something I've been seeing lately has been a discussion over whether or not we should be feeding wildlife indiscriminately, or are we creating a situation where we're going to be giving an advantage to non-native species and driving them out. And maybe, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. And it seems like that's just such a, to me, that's really at the heart of a lot of this, is how do we live with our neighbors, and do we need to worry about if they're native or non-native species? And animal, what about plants? How does somebody like me, who really has no clue and just likes green things and birds, get started in doing something good for urban environment and ecology rather than just willy-nilly?
Well, first thing I should say, I guess, is that the answer is not going to be a simple, straightforward answer. As
it never is.
Yeah, as one of my professors used to joke, you know, the trouble with ecologists is that they have two hands, because then they'll say on the one hand this and on the other hand that. So we always have different scenarios. But I think the question of non-native species becoming invasive is definitely a serious problem for many ecosystems. But it is a question of also thinking about it in a broader, in a specific context, because there you can't have a blanket, you know, hatred towards invasive species like some people have, or, you know, have one approach to it, because there are many instances where even species that have been moved around by humans have sort of gone native in ways that they are actually important to native species, right? So if you think about where we are, where I am right now in California, along the coast of California, you have monarch butterflies, the West Coast populations. They spend winter in many locations there. And guess what has become one of the common tree species where they winter? It's your Australian invasive, the eucalyptus.
Eucalyptus, right? Yes.
So, you know, so it's a tricky thing to then say, okay, you know, we need to get rid of all these, because then you have a native species that's migratory and perhaps threatened, that has become attached in a way to an invasive species. Huh. Of course, the invasive species debates, you know, people argue about invasive species, and some people take a pretty hardline view on all invasive species.
Mm-hmm.
But then to me, it seems like if you really want to be hardline, then what's the most invasive species on the planet right now? It's us. Right? We started in Africa, but we occupied every habitat and we've transformed the entire planet. So what do you really
I'm pretty
want
sure
to
the
back?
African continent. Yeah, I'm pretty sure the African continent doesn't want us back. So
of course. and that's the other question as well. So I think part of the problem to me where all this starts, and since you're a philosopher, you might appreciate or have thoughts on this as well. I think it's because we tend to view humans as being something separate from nature.
Yes.
As our actions are not part of the natural order somehow. So if we move species, we think of that as being something different from, let's say, you know, a migratory bird carrying, you know, little snails on its feet, or mm-hmm. you know, or what happened with cattle egrets, right? That's a species from Africa and Asia that arrived in the US without any human assistance in about 100 years ago. The first flocks were seen in Florida, and to anybody's best guess, it would seem that they were probably blown across from Africa on some strange wind, you know, one of these hurricane wind patterns that comes across the Atlantic. Well, a few birds were brought, were caught up in a storm, landed in Florida, and now you find them everywhere. And that's
the species, you're right.
Yet nobody is really concerned about that as an invasive species that needs to be controlled. Why? Right. Because they're not competing with any, there wasn't anything like a native cattle egret. And for those of you who may be wondering, you know, if anyone in the audience is wondering what a cattle egret is, you know, it's a little heron, and you know, they're called cattle egrets because they tend to follow large herbivores like cattle. And their strategy for finding food is that they, you know, go behind in a rhino or a, you know, elephant herds or cattle as they walk through a field, because when they walk through, they'll stir up all kinds of small invertebrates, which the cattle egret will then feed on. So they basically use these large animals as a way to stir up their own food.
And so those of you who've seen like National Geographic or mm-hmm. something, they're the little tiny birds that are bouncing along in the furrows and the churned up dirt mm-hmm. and going, thank you for all the bugs.
Yeah. There's really nothing like that in North America, in the New World. So these birds arrived here and they found this sort of empty niche, so to speak. And they've successfully colonized the continent without, as far as I know, causing any serious disruption to the ecosystem, which is different from some other species.
Yes, like
that might seriously disrupt. Yeah, like cats in Australia mm-hmm. or New Zealand.
Or here even.
And again, cats will sort of open up a huge can of worms in terms of conservation debates, and I'm not sure we really want to get into that.
No, we're just going to say cats debate and leave it at that, I think.
But I was going to say, even in that, you know, there's a question of context, because mm-hmm. Even in North America, the problems of cats may be because of the context in which they've been introduced, but if you go to India, I've not heard of anyone in the wildlife conservation community that are talking about cats as being a specific problem. Why? Because there's maybe half a dozen native small cat species
right.
that live in the wild there. You also have leopards and other, you know, there's many different species of cat. Tropics in general tend to have high diversity of species, so you have a high diversity of small carnivores.
Right.
Where, you know, the domestic cats don't
really... Australia, right? You get a place like Australia who doesn't have small carnivores, and then you introduce one, and that little carnivore sitting there going, "That quokka's real cute. I bet it tastes delicious."
Yep.
And suddenly you have no more quokkas. But that's an interesting nuance that I don't think we hear terribly often when we're talking about urban ecology and conservation. Is, you know, it seems to be people just want to be like, cat bad, but you know, other thing good, and what might be bad here in Philadelphia has a completely different meaning perhaps in, you know, a mega city in India or an island in the South Pacific.
And even in North America, where the domestic cat is a non-native species, I've argued about this with colleagues in many cases. I'm not entirely convinced from my research that for birds, cats may necessarily be as bad a problem uniformly as is perhaps portrayed sometimes.
I have wondered.
They do eat a lot of wildlife. They do eat a lot of birds. But what I've found in studying birds in urban habitats is that urban habitats actually tend to have a lot of resources for certain species of birds. So you tend to get a much greater abundance of birds in urban habitat than even outside. So for example, I started this work in Phoenix 15 years ago, and we have many years of data from Phoenix, which is the city in the middle of the desert, and it's also a city where a lot of water use has been concentrated by people. So you tend to generally get higher level of productivity of plants, and people have lawns, and they also have feeders and so on. So what that means is that it functions as an oasis, not just for people but also for wildlife. And you have the native desert fauna has a lot of species that are quite flexible in their and opportunistic in their in how they use resources. So hey, if they find more water and food available in the urban habitat, they'll just start using the urban habitat. So you tend to actually get more numbers of even native species in Phoenix than you get in the surrounding desert. So if the productivity, if the population productivity is higher in the city, and if the cats are taking a few of those, the overall impact on the population may not be as big. But on the other hand, if you have some threatened or endangered species that has a unique habitat requirement where human development is taking place and cats are coming in because of people, there they can have a negative impact. So again, you have to really look at the context and figure out more local solutions to some of these problems, I think.
You mentioned Phoenix, and I've spent quite a bit of time there. My grandparents lived there when I was a kid. Interesting place. Roadrunners always fascinated me. They're so strange looking. And you're now in, kind of the middle of California in Fresno. And those are two cities that are very well known for just sucking up massive amounts of water.
Oh, yes.
Massive. And for those of us on the East Coast coming off of the winter we just had, it's kind of like, here, by all means, let us give you some of our excess water. Would you like it? And I know that the West Coast is like, please, give me. But tying that, I think, into the notion of humans as an invasive species and not really understanding the impact that they have on the environment, it seems like water is probably, at least if you've ever lived on the West Coast, kind of the number one example of that. People just don't seem to understand the impact that their water use has everywhere. And you live in Fresno, which has a really interesting history with water, and I was wondering if you'd like to share.
Yeah, sure. Fresno is the Fresno and neighboring Clovis is sort of a cities that have grown together. So we are located in this in what's known as California's Central Valley, just near the San Joaquin River, which has been the basis for a lot of the agricultural development in the Central Valley. Right, this is the breadbasket of California, if not the U.S. And Fresno also happens to be the fifth largest city in California. The metro area is approaching 1 million in population. But it's also politically rather different from the typical perception people have of California, the West Coast liberals. Fresno is not like that. Fresno is, is very much driven by the agricultural history. There's also high degree of poverty, and there's also a fair degree of religious and political conservatism. And in that context, the interesting thing about water in Fresno is that Fresno is one of the last cities in California to install residential water meters. Right? Just think about that. We're talking about a city in a region that gets in a good year maybe 10 or 11 inches of rain. Of course, right now we are in a multi-year drought of historic proportions, so the water precipitation has been much less. Yet the city did not have water meters. In fact, in the early 90s, the population in the city beat back ballot measures on the question of whether to install meters. Around the same time as Tucson in Arizona actually installed meters and went with a pretty aggressive tiered water pricing structure, which transformed Tucson, right?
Right.
I like to compare Tucson and Fresno because they are about similar sized cities, maybe with some demographic similarities as well, but very different history because of this different choices they made in the late 80s and early 90s in terms of water policy. So what has happened with Fresno is that maybe you know, within the last decade or so, as the city has grown and the city's water needs increase, and most of the water supply for the city is groundwater, right? So just sucked up from below. And because of the way, the peculiar way that water resources are managed in California, groundwater is basically local jurisdiction. So the city, nobody could tell the city to put in water meters. If the population said, we don't want water meters, that's how you could go. But what has happened is as the city grew, the city also now has claims on water from the San Joaquin River. There's a dam upstream from which the city can claim water, especially as the groundwater levels start depleting. So what happened is the state agencies and the federal agencies that manage the dam and allocation of water from the dam, they told the city that if you want your share of water from here, you have to put in meters. So they took the decision out of the local hands, which has not gone down very well, you know, all that well with the local population. They didn't have a choice. So
yeah, it's not a good thing to do, especially in a very conservative area, conservative area, if you want to stay friendly with the people who live there.
But what that meant is that it actually provided me and my collaborators here with a nice urban ecology experiment, because here we had a city with water that was essentially unrestricted. You know, there was this sort of nominal flat monthly fee, and you could use as much water as you want.
Amazing.
In 2 years ago, in 2013, was the first year that they fully implemented residential water meters. So people actually now have to pay according to the amount of water they use, even though the rates are still being negotiated. So it's not very high. And the city water department wants to raise the rates, and that's a contentious issue in the city council right now. But nevertheless, the cost of water went up for a lot of people who were used to having lush lawns, like ones you might find in Philadelphia in the summer, right? So, and we've been studying this sort of experimental change in the city's water policy, you know, going from flat rate water to metered pricing, and what that means to how people use their water, especially because, well, let me drop some numbers on you. The average per capita water use in Fresno before metering, now this is, I think 2012 was the last year we had, metering kicked in, the city's estimate was that the average person in the residential sector used something like 340 gallons per day. Yes, right. This is, we were already in the drought in 2012. So there's a huge quantity of water being used. And of course, it shocked me when I learned these numbers. And
for those of you wondering why I'm squeaking, I grew up in California in the 80s, and we were under drought for a couple of years. Those of you who are roughly, you know, my age might remember it. You might remember actually like having your little gallon of water where you could like do everything you needed to for the day. You could use it to brush your teeth, all of that. And so hearing, that much water waste, oh my gosh.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. So, the other statistic is that about 70% of that water use goes into the landscape. Why are people doing this? Well, I collaborated with social scientists here. We did a survey of populations in Fresno. We also had some focus groups that Kaveri conducted a couple of years ago. And we've been trying to get at that question of, why is it that people use so much water in the landscape? What is it that they want from their landscape? And it turns out that we're calling this sort of, there's a cultural inertia, because people's expectation of their suburban landscape is that you want a bit of lawn for aesthetic reasons, for kids to play on, and so on. So the dominant model of a suburban home is the home with a yard that is green and has a few trees, and again these trees might also be relatively thirsty trees. So while the amount of water used may shock someone who's aware of how little water is available here, on the other hand, if you think about, if your goal is to have a lawn and trees and that kind of a typical landscape, you're going to have to pour in that much water here, right? You don't need to. And I remember showing these data to colleagues in Germany who were initially shocked. And then one of the urban plant ecologists in Germany said to me, well, we don't use that much water here because it rains, so we don't need to use it. If you want grass, you're going to have to pour water in. So in a way, within that context of what you want out of your landscape, it's logical to use that much water. But it doesn't fit in with the context of how much water is actually available. So what we are engaged in now, what we want to do, and this gets back to your earlier question about what can you as an individual do. I think there's a role to sort of getting people to understand the ecological context in which they live, and also change these mental models of what your landscape is supposed to look like. Right? The American lawn has been such a hugely dominant feature of the American home that it's a strong cultural model. People want lawns. And lawns are the number one, in terms of acreage, I believe lawns are the top crop in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. I was telling Madhu when we were in the green room ahead of time, since I used to go to Fresno when I was a kid, we had family, friends, I guess, who lived there. I was pretty young. I was young enough, actually, that when I first started reading about desert oases and stuff, I didn't think of palm trees and ponds and, the kind of typical Arabian Nights sort of thing. I thought of Fresno, because Fresno was literally just this, driving from San Jose to Fresno was the most miserable, hot thing you could do in the summer. Our car didn't have air conditioning. It was just miles of pebbles and brown dirt, dust, and then suddenly you would pass into the Fresno city limit and green everywhere. Lawns fountains and pools and big old trees of all different kinds, and you could literally feel the temperature drop just from all of the sudden leafy coverage that you were coming into. And so for a 4, 5, 6-year-old, that was an oasis. Mm-hmm. And I can totally see in my mind how that much water was being used, but I'm also still just blown away. But you're right, that's very much the post-World War II suburban dream of the lawn and the picket fence and the apple tree.
Exactly.
You make your apple pies.
Exactly. So what has happened is, Tucson, from my understanding of the history of Tucson, it used to be like this up until the 80s. But when they switched to metering, they also fairly quickly switched to implemented a pretty, steeply tiered pricing for water. So basically, for a certain minimum use per month, the rates were low. But if you went above that in 2 or 3 steps, your water bill would really jump up significantly by an order of magnitude, which meant that people had a strong economic incentive to change the way they viewed their landscape. And now, if you go to Tucson now, if you've been in recent years, or if anyone goes now, you'll notice that you don't find lawns everywhere. People have a lot more native plants, a lot more desert adapted plants, or a lot more what we call water wise gardens.
Xeriscaping came out of that area, didn't it?
Yeah. And that's, it's, you know, the ecologically sort of technically accurate term is xeriscaping, X-E-R-I, xeri, which refers to dry. And, you know, xeriscaping, I guess zero water use is the idea. So that transformation has happened there, and we are hoping to see something similar, perhaps, you know, as a model that might happen here as well as water prices go up and as the drought continues. Because I think it's the combination of water suddenly becoming a little more expensive and the drought, which has become a big part of everybody's consciousness now, that has resulted in a process of change that we are actually trying to measure at the moment in Fresno. Because if you come to Fresno now, if you did that drive from San Jose, it's pretty dry all the way through. And even in Fresno, lots and lots of lawns are dry. So much so that this last 4th of July, the city on 4th of July with the fireworks and, you know, and doesn't have a large central fireworks display, so people tend to use fireworks everywhere. So the city actually lifted water restrictions for that evening and told people they could water their lawns because they were afraid of fires starting because the grass is too dry.
Yeah, so, that's an interesting side effect, right? You have an area of the country, in California especially, fires in California are really very serious. California actually had firestorms before just about anyone else, so they're really good at fighting fires now. But fires are scary. So now you've got a place that's had, 50 years of unlimited water use and lush lawns and trees, and 2 years on from actually having to pay for their water. I bet the place is very dry, and suddenly you have an awful lot of kindling. Wow. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. The place is very dry, and those who can afford it are actually ripping their grass out and beginning to put in other things. One of the peculiar things that's happening is because people are still hung up on having a green appearance.
Uh-oh.
We do see a number of places people are putting in artificial turf, which is an abomination.
Painting it. I thought you were going to say they weren't painting.
I've heard of that too, but artificial turf is going in, and we are trying to. And so what we're trying to do is sort of, you know, see if you can educate people about other alternatives, because the alternative to grass is not necessarily gravel or sand or what the typical image of a desert landscape is, you know, or xeriscape is. It's not just cacti and gravel.
Right.
You can have a lot of a diversity of wildflowering plants, native and not necessarily native, but also from other desert regions. That will do well with low water, and that provide an aesthetically beautiful yard.
There's some really lovely grasses even that grow in very limited water. They have beautiful flower and plants, and it's very surprising, especially because my initial, of course, exposure to a low water landscape was, you know, the Southwest rock garden cacti thing. My grandparents actually have that. They were really big into nature stuff, and so that's what I thought. So when I started seeing, one of my guilty pleasures, I will admit, is the Chelsea Garden Show, and every year it's a beautiful BBC garden show, and I find ways to watch it. And the first year I saw a desert low water landscape with grass and flowers and trees, my mind was blown away. I had no idea. And it seems so sad that people don't know they can have these absolutely gorgeous lawns that are great for wildlife as opposed to astroturf.
Exactly. And, you know, and UC Davis here has actually developed a variety of grass that requires much less water than the standard turf grass. So there are alternatives, and I think this is all sort of goes back into applying some of our scientific understanding to change mindsets and these cultural models which dictate mm-hmm. how we use resources and whether or not we allow other species to coexist with us in our habitat. So, you know, this whether you're talking about coexisting with carnivores in urban areas, or whether you're talking about how much water you use and how much water you take away from other species, all of that comes down to the human, our expectations of our habitat and how we perceive mm-hmm. that as being distinct from nature.
And what leads actually really nicely into a question from the chat room that I've been sitting on for like half an hour at this point. Ilse wants to know, she uses the example of giant kangaroos used to exist in Australia. And by used to exist, we're talking a long time ago, because when the Aboriginal Australian ancestors came over, then giant kangaroo became food. And she wants to know, are we approaching a point where we're going to be happy to have any animals that can live near us at all? Are we chasing diversity and species away? Are we just killing everything in our paths, and we should just be happy to have the invasive species, or is it a little bit better than that?
I think it's a little bit better than that. I've been involved in another global collaboration. This is a research team called UrbioNet. It's a National Science Foundation funded project, and we have been collecting data on wildlife in urban habitats from cities around the world. And mm-hmm. The first paper that came out of this collaboration was published about a year ago, where we looked at species diversity in birds and plants in a total of around 150 cities, right, from every continent.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found is that the picture is less depressing than people might expect when they think about urban habitat. So what was not surprising was that, of course, cities had fewer species than you would expect from the surrounding habitat, right? And that shouldn't be a surprise, because cities are not built as wildlife habitat anyway. Given that, what's actually surprising is how many species actually still occur in the cities. And I'm talking native species. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about birds in cities, people tend to think about, oh, it's mostly pigeons and starlings and house sparrows. And turns out that's not really representative of what you actually find. You find... we found in a total of 54 cities where we have lists of species that have been documented to regularly use urban habitat, over 2,000 species of birds occur in just these 54 cities.
Wow.
Now, to give you the context, there's an estimated 10,000 or so bird species in the world. So we're talking about 20% of the avifauna of the planet seems to be able to persist fairly well in urban habitat.
So the cities that you're looking at, I'm assuming you're talking about a variety of sizes from smaller towns all the way up through the mega cities?
Yes, yes. It includes, for example, Calcutta, which is, or Singapore. These are cities in our data set. And you know, Calcutta has over 300 species of birds documented occurring regularly. Yeah. Right here in Fresno, I've been running a citizen science, you know, project, the Fresno Bird Count, and we're approaching, I think we have over 80 species of birds that our volunteers have documented as, you know, occurring in the city every spring. So yes, there's a handful of species that tend to be common, and we tend to think of, you know, pigeons and starlings and these things as being the common urban birds. But there's a lot of native species that do quite well in the city as well. And one of the things that people might think about is, you know, if you switch away from this lawn mindset to something that's a bit more diverse, with a greater diversity of wildflowers, for example, you might actually attract more wildlife and a greater number of species that are native. So hummingbirds and, you know, insect-eating birds.
Mm-hmm.
These kinds of things might find more room if you reduce the lawn and go towards a more mixed kind of a landscape. So the picture is, you know, I mean, in some ways, yes, you know, cities as they're growing, we're definitely encroaching and destroying other habitats and pushing many species to the brink of extinction. But again, we need to think of this as a more dynamic evolutionary process. The other species might also adapt to human habitat.
So that kind of goes into the question that we had earlier in the mm-hmm. show, which was about the Galapagos finches in general and species evolving to mm-hmm. deal with humans or not. And kind of the overall impression in the Second Life chat room is that there's no way species can actually evolve fast enough to deal with humans and the effects to humans. But you wrote this really interesting piece that was published in The Conversation last year that mm-hmm. seems to suggest that this is not always the case, that actually songbirds can change their song rapidly.
Yep.
And to live in a noisy environment and still be yes. heard and other things. So is that actually, can I guess, really rapid evolution happen fast enough that animals, some at least, can keep up with us?
Yeah, and this is definitely an area of great active research interest right now, is estimating rates of evolution and potential adaptability of species in the face of climate change. Mm-hmm. I think what we're finding is that different species might evolve at different rates, and some of that depends on how variable the species are and how flexible their behaviors might be and so on. So certainly species that have very specialized habitat requirements, or have some peculiar association with some other species in terms of a symbiosis or something like that, where they're a tight evolutionary relationship, they might be more vulnerable and they cannot change and adapt as rapidly. But other species mm-hmm. might occupy a broader range of habitat might have the flexibility to be able to adapt and change as the habitat around them changes. So, we might see a general wildlife becoming more generalist, perhaps, to some extent, than mm-hmm. having and some of the specialized unique adaptations might be lost, perhaps. But it's hard to generalize across because we don't know in many cases how fast they may or may not be able to evolve in response to change. So, for example, you talked about the bird song, and yes, song and more studies are finding that birds or even frogs that live in urban habitat and have to deal with background noise are able to change their vocal communication to be able to survive in noisy environments. The occurrence of urban light, right, has changed the right. behavior of nightingales in Europe, for example. So they sing at different times now, and they're active mm-hmm. earlier through the night. And what long-term consequences that have, we're still figuring out. Bears around Lake Tahoe, for example, where people have been building these cabins and there's more garbage available through the winter. Some bears have given up hibernation because they can find food in the winter. So that's the kind of a physiological change that can also lead to an evolutionary change in the long term. So some species will adapt, others won't. And I think what we can do, and this is where I, use the framework of reconciliation ecology in my teaching as well, where I think if we understand that and accept that nature and wildlife are also dynamic over an evolutionary timescale and they're involved in an evolutionary process, rather than treating it as something as human effect as a distinct category.
Mm-hmm.
What that allows us, I think it allows us to look at our own modifications of habitat and the technology that we use and how we change the landscapes as something that the other species will respond to. So we might have some and the more we understand about how other species respond to human habitat, the more fine-tuning we can do to make changes that will allow the other species to coexist with us and in a way sort of soften that edge between human and nature.
So it sounds like a big thing that you would like us to take away is that we don't just impact the animals and the plants that we live with inside our house. You know, it's not just the cat on the table with me. It's not just the prayer plant hanging in the corner. But, you know, I also live in the environment around me, in the streets and the plants and the flora and the fauna around me. And I shouldn't think of myself as separate from that environment, but as part of the dynamic environment. And so I'm going to impact the creatures around me, but those things around me will change and respond to me because I am part of the environment. So, yes, I change the environment, but I've always changed the environment. And so
And every species changes the environment it lives in a way. It's always a dynamic relationship. Every species takes resources from the environment and converts it into, plants will grow, and in the process they will outcompete other plants. Right? They produce flowers to attract pollinators, and they might at the same time produce nasty chemicals to repel other things that are trying to eat them. You have, and that's how sort of ecosystem interactions build up with species responding to one another. We just happen to be the sort of this big, 800-pound gorilla of a species that really makes huge impact on ecosystems, especially on a local scale in the urban context, but also globally, because it's not just, what you do in your house or in your yard, but also, if you're planting something that maybe low water use around here, but it turns out, a lot of, in terms of people wanting pretty flowers, there are lots of low water using beautiful flower options that will attract pollinators and so on, that will support insects that are available, but they may not be native species. So you might be getting something from a similar ecological region in Australia or South America, a desert adapted plant. So your impact, you're transforming the landscape on a global scale in that way as well. And of course the resources we use, right? So if you drink coffee, for example, are you drinking coffee that, where does it come from, right? Is it coming from habitat that supports migratory birds in the Caribbean, right? This bird friendly coffee. We can make choices that might, in anything we do, that can have a positive effect in terms of supporting biodiversity and other species. Not just in your yard, but also on a global scale. So I think it sort of, the answer is not straightforward for individuals, but I think being more mindful of the fact that you are a species in a complex web of interactions in an ecosystem, to me, that's sort of an empowering thing to take from evolutionary ecology, is that, and taking the long-term evolutionary view, right? The biodiversity on this planet has gone through many extinction events, and we think that we are in this human-driven extinction event right now, but life has recovered from most of those. So the question is, are we able to learn lessons from that process and modulate our own actions in ways that we don't necessarily cause an extinction event? And
it's sort of the big arrogance, I guess, to assume that we humans are above it all, including extinction, I think.
That's the negative side of the arrogance on one side. But on the other hand, I also am coming to thinking that often, and this is a term that ecologists are beginning to use more now, is this idea of stewardship. Right? That maybe we are different from many other species because we are, most extinction events were not really driven by a single species. In this case, a single species, us, has radically transformed the entire planet in ways that are causing long-term evolutionary changes for other species. So maybe because... because
that idea of stewardship and participation, though, involvement in it, not just being separate from it. There's something really compellingly beautiful about that idea.
Yeah, I think so. And that's what I call reconciliation ecology, especially in the urban context. This is there are opportunities for us to reconcile human development and human well-being with conserving biodiversity and wildlife in places where we live, because mm-hmm. recognizing that we are part of this complex web of interactions and we have evolved and other species continue to evolve, and also at the same time recognizing that we have the technology and, you know, and the intellectual power for good or ill to transform landscapes in such a big way, maybe we can apply that power for good by being more mindful of the changes we make in our landscapes, in things that you plant in your yard and things that you encourage your, you know, city to adopt policies that might support wildlife, that kind of thing, to transform the landscapes where we live so that maybe whatever ride we are in for with climate change, maybe it's not as rough as many of us fear it's going to be. Right? We might find ways to ride it out in ways that are mm-hmm. gentler and that allow more species to sort of come along with us rather than...
Yeah, that's I think we might have found where the optimists are hiding. Maybe they're all in urban ecology. It's a nice message from the climate scientists or the most depressed scientists in the world article that was going around earlier this week. It was, you know, climate scientists have the most depressing job. Well, maybe it's a little bit more hopeful if you're looking at urban ecology and thinking a little bit more in the terms of stewardship and living within the web of ecology rather than just beating it mercilessly with a sledgehammer.
Yeah, I like that. I like that.
I have to say, it's also, you know, you always hear people talking about urban ecology and, oh, we're encouraging all of these horrible pigeons and pigeon rat squirrel things and starlings. And I like the fact that actually what you illustrated your conversation piece with last year is something that I don't think anyone could look at and be like, stone it. It's a beautiful mm-hmm. picture of a San Joaquin baby fox, and they apparently find survival easier in suburbia.
Well, in Bakersfield, just south of here, that's the best place to see them. So they live under school buildings
mm-hmm.
with children running around in the daytime, and you have fox dens under the buildings.
That's kind of amazing. And I think it's nice to hear about that kind of thing. We don't often enough, mm-hmm. I don't think. At least I know when I hear about species adapting to humans and the environment, it's always, we're making the raccoons smarter. You know, it's mm-hmm. been a little side chat in the second life room tonight has been, you know, Toronto's raccoons have adapted and are very good scavengers. They can open locks and garbage cans. Chicago's reporting the same thing. I know that we've got at least two different raccoons here, because I can recognize them by their face markings, who very clearly understand that if they could just lift up the screen to the windows, they could come inside and have the food that's inside. And you can see them trying with their little tiny hands.
And one day someone will figure it out.
The cats, mm-hmm. thankfully, are useful. In that one very specific instance, the cats will stop fighting with each other and they will mm-hmm. aim at the enemy who is coming for their food, which is, of course, the one thing the cats care about. But we hear about these, and these are always, I think, almost portrayed as pest animals. Mm-hmm. You know, the pest of the raccoon, the pest of the American opossum, the pest of the pigeon, of the squirrel.
Yep.
And you don't really hear about. And then this adorable little fox can mm-hmm. survive better in a suburban landscape. And maybe some of the conversation needs to switch a little bit away from these pests and a little bit more towards, hey, monarch butterflies might be able to, you know, stay because we have eucalyptus trees in California.
Yeah, and I think, again, it comes down to a great deal to our mindsets and our model of what nature is supposed to be. And I think you know, nature and these wild species don't really care what our models are. They are going to do whatever it takes to survive. And if that means mm-hmm. you know, learning how to open cans or or as you know, house sparrows and starlings have done. They you know, you find house sparrows, for example, nesting in Home Depots or garden stores.
Yes.
And they've figured out how to operate the automatic doors. They can open. So, you know, you do what it takes, and those that figure it out survive and leave behind offspring. That's how the evolutionary process works. So we might have problems with our, you know, valuation of certain species over others. And if we broaden our perspective and consider that we actually share this planet with a wide array of species, whether we like them or not, you know, set that aside, then maybe we can make more room for a lot more wildlife.
Yeah, I think that's a very hopeful place for us to end this evening. I know that you all have so many questions for Matu, and you're probably going to have them as things go on. Those of you who are listening later on, he has a really active Twitter presence at Leaf Warbler, and he also has a blog at valleycafesci.wordpress.com, where you can also find his podcast, which is monthly.
I'd be happy to answer questions people might have, you know, through any medium.
That's great, and you can also find him on his Fresno State website, and he's really accessible, folks. So I encourage you to give questions, seek him out, and learn more. You too can become an optimist about how humans and animals might live, you know? It's nice. Often as a bioethicist, I end these conversations and I'm just like, would somebody please hand me the vodka? And, you know, it's nice. It's nice to leave on a little bit more optimistic note for once.
Yeah, you know, in as much as we cannot perfectly forecast the future, I think there's always room for optimism, because you're not sure it's going to be as bad as you think it's going to be. Maybe it will, maybe it won't, because pessimism denotes some certainty, and I don't think we have that certainty in our ability.
Yeah. It's a refreshing way to look at things, especially after a long, long day of governmental sessions.
Yeah.
So it's like a little bit of optimism at the end of the night. Thank you so much for being here, Madhu. This was fantastic. I really enjoyed this so much, and I learned so much, and that's always so exciting for me. And I would also like to extend my thanks to Sherry, as always, who is incredibly patient with me, and I am the most scatterbrained host in the world, and she's fantastic. And thank our hosts in the Second Life, the Exploratorium, first love of my life, first museum that I spent all of my time at, so it's always very exciting to be able to say thank you, both for stoking my love of science when I was a kid and for hosting us now here in Second Life. And for the rest of you, I will talk to you on Twitter, I'm sure, sooner rather than later. And otherwise, I'll see you next month. Have a lovely evening, everyone. Good night.
Good night.